Hi everyone and welcome. My name is Jamie and this is True Crime Talkers San Diego, episode number 2. Today I've got a very interesting case for you guys. It involves aliens, cults, and tracksuits paired with Nike tennis shoes. Quite the fashion statement indeed. But before we get into today's main case, I have a very important announcement to make. As of January 7th, Maya, also known as Mae Millette, has gone missing. She was last seen at her home in San Miguel Ranch, and both of her cars were left in the driveway. So her family suspects that she may have gone for a walk after an argument with her husband. She lives about a block away from Mount San Miguel Park, and is described as being a very adventurous and outdoorsy person, so it wouldn't be out of character for her to go blow off some steam and maybe go walk one of the trails over there. On Wednesday the 13th, more than 100 people searched Chula Vista, mostly focusing on the trails and canyons or caves, any place where maybe she might have fallen or have gotten stuck. Her family says she's never done anything like this and that she's not the type of person to just up and leave without talking to anyone. Mae is a very beautiful woman. She's 35 and has 3 young children, and they even had plans to go to Big Bear with the whole family to celebrate her oldest daughter's birthday, which was just last week. She would have never left her kids for this long, and she especially would have never missed her daughter's birthday. Now, in an interview, Mae's brother-in-law did allude that there may be some red flags when it comes to the husband, but that they're just going to leave it up to the police and that they don't want to jump to any conclusions, which I think is smart, because it's very important to keep an open mind. You never know. Mae and her husband have been together since they were 18, and they've been married for 22 years, which, I mean, that's almost my entire life, so that really does say something. They definitely have that longevity, the foundation of commitment, they have children together, so I'm not going to jump to any conclusions either. And the police do say that her husband has been very cooperative with them and that an investigation is being conducted. As of now, there's no signs of any foul play, so the CVPD are handling it as a missing persons case. Obviously, her family and friends are still holding out hope for her return, and so am I. I really do have to say, her family and friends have done such a great job of getting her story out there. They've made shirts, posters, flyers, you name it, they've contacted the news stations, they're doing everything in their power to bring her home safe to them. They've even started up a Facebook page called Help Find Mae, where they've organized search parties, they had a candlelight vigil, they're doing virtual prayers. They posted clips from the news stations, and it's just a place where they update everyone with what's going on. So I'll link the page in the description. Make sure you go check it out. I'm also going to link their Venmo account if you would like to make a donation to help. And they also just started a GoFundMe page as well. And the goal for the fundraiser is to help finance a private investigator and any additional investigative services. So I highly recommend donating to them. Anything would help, I'm sure. I believe both the GoFundMe and Venmo are at Help Find Mae, but again, I will link it, so no worries about that. I honestly can't imagine the nightmare that they must all be going through, and I'm really hoping that we can help them. I hope this is another platform to help get her story and name out there. So anything we can do to help, you know, let's do it. Mae is described as being 5'2", about 105 pounds, with brown hair, brown eyes, freckles, and a wrist tattoo. So if you have any information, please contact the Chula Vista Police Department at 619-691-5151. My heart truly does go out to her family and friends. She will be in my prayers, and I do hope that she returns home safely and very soon. Speaking of safety, I do have a safety tip. Well, it's more of a safety product, and this is not sponsored, but I do want to turn you guys on to this product that I just heard about. So there's this company called Invisiware that makes these gold charms, and you can have it on a bracelet or a necklace or a keychain. But these charms are not just any ordinary charm, no. They act as panic buttons for whenever you feel unsafe. So the charm has this button on the back, and if you double tap it, then it will send a text message out to 5 emergency contacts of your choosing, and it will also send them your current location. And then you can also program it to have them contact 911 as well. I think this is really cool because if you're in a situation where you feel unsafe and, you know, maybe someone is stalking you or possibly you're being attacked by someone, this saves you from having to, you know, fumble around for your phone, trying to text or call someone. There's not always time for that, or you'll drop it or they take your phone. Anything like that could happen. So with this, you know, you just press your little charm and bada bing, bada boom, people are alerted and you can have a little peace of mind with that. You know, stories like Maya just remind me that you can never be over-prepared for any emergency situation, whether it be an attack or you find yourself lost or trapped somewhere, you know, especially if you're a woman, unfortunately. So this is a product that I find really intriguing. I am thinking of doing van life, so I may be traveling alone from time to time. So this is something that would make me feel a lot safer, and I know it would make my family feel a lot more comfortable as well. But again, this is not sponsored, but to the folks at Invisiware, wink, wink, wink. Let's talk about one of the most recognizable mass suicides that shook America more than 20 years ago. This is a sci-fi-based cult called Heaven's Gate. Now, the earliest incarnation of Heaven's Gate began in the 1970s under the leadership of Marshall Applewhite and Bonnie Nettles. Marshall Applewhite was born in 1931 in Texas and was known as always being a charming fellow who had a musical talent. He had always had a dream of being a singer and actor, and eventually moved to New York with his wife and child in hopes of making that dream a reality. However, show business can be a tough cookie, and Marshall soon became depressed from not getting the roles that he had wanted. So this obviously put a strain on his 16-year marriage, and sadly, it eventually dissolved. He later ends up leaving New York and spends most of his career as a music teacher at various theaters and universities. However, that profession did not necessarily pan out the way he wanted either, for it's rumored that he gets fired as a music professor at the University of St. Thomas for having a sexual relationship with one of his male students. And then just to make things even worse, his father, whom he was very, very close to, dies in the 1970s. So all of this combined just completely sends him over the edge into a deep depression and possibly a nervous breakdown. Marshall eventually finds himself in a hospital, although the reason for why he's in the hospital is a bit murky. Some people think it was for heart surgery, while others believe it was for mental health problems. But whatever the case may be, the hospital definitely changes his life forever, because it is there that he meets his future partner in crime, Bonnie Nettles. Now, the true story of how these two originally meet is also a bit murky, because in an interview, Bonnie's daughter, Terry Nettles, explains that her mother met Marshall at their local theater in Houston in 1972, because that's where he was teaching music classes. Now, Bonnie is a very religious gal. She's also really into space and astrology, which I can relate to on the astrology thing. I'm super into it too. So at the theater, while her daughter was taking her class, Bonnie would do astrological charts for the other mothers. And I guess she somehow managed to do Marshall's chart as well. Now, if you don't know what an astrological chart is, it's also referred to as a natal chart. And it's basically the astronomical snapshot of the stars based on the exact day, time, and place that you were born. And this information just helps you better understand who you are, your personality, why you think and do and act in certain ways. So it's actually pretty interesting. I would encourage anyone to look into your natal chart if you haven't already. But anyways, you can tell a lot about a person from their chart. So Bonnie did Marshall's chart, and Terry remembers her mother saying that there was something about his chart that was just different and special. It set him apart from everyone else, and she was definitely very attracted to that. Not in a romantic way, but just, you know, attracted to that type of personality. But no matter which version of the story you believe, it is clear that these two really hit it off and got to know each other in that hospital where Bonnie would attend Marshall as one of his nurses. So they're in the hospital, right? They get to talking, and they soon discover that they both have very similar religious and spiritual beliefs, and so that's something that they really bond over together. The two of them became convinced that they were the two witnesses as described in the Christian book of Revelation, who were both slain and then ascend into heaven, and that they were both tasked in preparing the way for the kingdom of heaven. So they form a very close but non-sexual relationship where they're kind of like the yin to each other's yang, if that makes sense. And then they even give each other nicknames, which is kind of adorable. They ended up calling each other Bo and Peep, or Winnie and Pooh, but the most notable names that they later go by in the cult is Marshall would go by Doe, and Bonnie would go by T, which is a nod to the musical scale. So on New Year's Day of 1973, they decide to essentially run away together on a spiritual road trip. Bonnie leaves her children with her ex-husband, but she does keep her daughter updated with letters on all of the adventures and things that she and Marshall end up doing. On this road trip, the two of them create their version of a religion, and they go about spreading the good word. Now, Bonnie knew the Bible inside and out, and was a big influence in the belief systems that they held, while Marshall was the charming front man that would bring followers into the fold. So they were definitely quite the dynamic duo. In September of 1975, they really start to put their name on the map, because Marshall and Bonnie go to a small town in Walport, Oregon, where they give a lecture about how UFOs will soon make contact with the human race, and that those who follow their teachings will be beamed up into salvation. So they strongly encourage their listeners to join their group, which at that time was called Human Individual Metamorphism, or Total Overcomers Anonymous. Which, I guess they're both kind of mouthful, so they made a good move with the Heaven's Gate name. So at first, the small town obviously thought that this was some sort of far-fetched joke, that no one would believe in this, these people are kooks. However, that wasn't the case, because they actually garnered widespread publicity after 20 people told their loved ones goodbye and disappeared from Oregon. Now remember, this was a small town, so 20 people just packing up and hitting the road was very noticeable. So let's talk about some of the things that Heaven's Gate really believed in and would preach to their followers, because it's actually pretty interesting. So their entire philosophy is basically centered around grafting the idea of aliens onto Christian theology. So for example, Marshall would tell his followers that he is the second coming of Christ and that God is actually an alien traveling around in a spaceship. He claimed that the humans on Earth were living in the end times and that God was planning to recycle the Earth, but that they would be saved if they could cleanse themselves and ascend to the evolutionary level above human, or Elah, E-L-A-H. So when you hear Elah, that's what he's referring to. He also refers to God and aliens on the spaceship as the Elah beings. Michael Conyers was an early recruit, and in interviews he would explain that the cult's message was appealing to him because they were talking to his Christian heritage but in a modern and updated way. For example, Heaven's Gate would explain that Virgin Mary was actually impregnated after being taken up in a spacecraft. In reference to that, Michael says, quote, "Now, as unbelievable as that sounds, that was an answer that was better than just plain virgin birth. It was technical, and it had physicality to it." Now, back in that time, science fiction was becoming very, very, very popular. I know my mom is a huge Trekkie fan still to this day. So people back then really had this somewhat sense of mania for contact with extraterrestrials and future technologies and exploring space. Which I honestly find pretty funny in juxtaposition to today, because we literally have confirmation from our government about aliens and that there's some sort of galactic federation, but literally no one cares. If only that news had come out in the 70s, like, people probably would have lost their minds. It would have been completely life-changing for them and exciting and probably scary as well. So incorporating sci-fi into your religion was a really good selling point back then, because it would offer some, you know, outlandish ideals, but they would also be familiar to people since it heavily borrowed from Christianity. But with all of that said, Heaven's Gate did have a rocky start. The group would travel around and try to make money however they could. They would sell blood at blood banks, ask for contributions at Christian bookstores, and some members even gave their trust funds to the cause. But despite their struggles, they were able to accumulate a decent-sized following. Now, once you joined the cult, there were very strict rules that you did have to follow. For one, there would be no sex and no socializing, and they were not to have what Marshall describes as any sort of human-level relationship. Followers were also dressed mainly in the same way, and they were to refuse any individuality. So in Marshall's words, he says, quote, "You have to abort the mind that you had as a human and leave everything that you knew behind you. And once you abandon your human ways, you will then need to become a new individual, and a new creature is born." So yeah, to join Heaven's Gate, you basically had to abandon everything you knew, say goodbye to all your family and friends. Like, he made it very clear that once you join, you're starting a new life, essentially. The old you is dead. All the people you knew, you don't talk to them anymore, because they're just going to distract you from your mission, which is to cleanse yourself from any sort of humanity and raise you to this next level above humans. So ex-cult member Michael Conyers also explains how the most mundane tasks had such strict regulations. He describes how something as small as even just making pancakes had a certain way of being done. There's the mixture, and then you had to have the pancake be a specific size. You had to cook it for this amount of time on one side, and the burner had to be set at this heat, and people got X amount of pancakes. And there was a specific way that you had to pour the syrup. All of this was to make sure that everything was an exact duplicate. That was very, very important. I mean, if that's not micromanagement, I don't know what is. I literally cannot imagine having to be under that kind of pressure 24/7 and to completely lose all sense of creativity and uniqueness in your life. Like, oh, I would not function well in that environment. Mm-mm. But that was the way things were in Heaven's Gate. After all, it was a cult, and the main ingredient for any cult is to completely take over a person's sense of identity. You have to make them believe that their identity is that of the cult. So it was important to isolate and separate people from who they once were, and especially from the rest of society, kind of give them a us versus them perspective on the world, which is a really toxic mindset. But it is essential, especially if you're a cult leader, because if you want the power to convince your followers to do virtually anything and to adopt a certain set of beliefs, then you have to walk them through this process of indoctrination. One of the first few members to join was a 19-year-old guy named David Moore. He found the cult's teachings very appealing and decided that that's what he wanted to do. So he told his mother goodbye and walked out the door. She was obviously very confused and worried for her son. Lots of families felt the exact same way when their kids and family members would just leave and not keep in contact with them. So David's mother eventually creates a newsletter to help the other shunned families. So with all of this attention that Heaven's Gate was receiving from the families and reporters asking what Marshall considered to be very annoying questions, so they decided, you know what, we've had enough. We don't want this amount of attention. And they decided to take the cult underground. So in 1976, Heaven's Gate lives on campgrounds around what they refer to as good energy states, which are California, Colorado, and Arizona. Which I guess it's nice to know that we live in a good energy state. So there you go. Now at that time, the cult was around 60 to 70 people, and they were all completely isolated from the rest of society. And Marshall explains to them that this is actually good because it's going to give them all time to focus on their change, so that way they can be ready when the UFO does come. However, even though they were underground technically, the paranoia still continued. Marshall views David's mom as an agent of the lower forces. His words, not mine. He's constantly looking over his shoulder at this time, and he keeps thinking that someone is out there trying to stop them from completing their important mission. So eventually, to keep the worried families off their back, Marshall does allow the members to check in with their loved ones, just so they can tell them, you know, hey, we're doing okay, I'm happy, I'm not hurt, I'm where I want to be, and like basically don't bother coming after them or try to stop them. So, as you can tell, Marshall seemed to be very uptight, and in the early 80s, cracks were definitely starting to appear within Heaven's Gate. People were starting to want to quit the cult, and Terry Nettles even says that she got a letter from her mother, Bonnie, alluding that she even wanted out. One of Bonnie and Marshall's major problems was that they were operating the cult on a clock. They preached that the world would soon be recycled and everything would be completely wiped clean, but that they wouldn't have to worry because the Telebeans would come and save them in their spaceship long before the apocalypse. However, fate had other plans and threw a wrench into their belief systems. Sadly, in 1985, Bonnie gets brain cancer and dies alone in her native state of Texas. Now, Bonnie's death shook Marshall in so many ways. He lost his partner in crime, and now his followers were beginning to question his teachings. Because why would a messenger of God die and her body be left on Earth before the Telebeans came? That just doesn't fit the narrative. So Marshall had to flip the script real quick and try and explain her death. He begins to preach that the human body is merely only a vessel or a vehicle, and that these vehicles could be abandoned when humans are ready to ascend to the next level. So according to Marshall, she had just simply exited her vehicle in order to join the Tela, and that he had to stay behind and continue the work. So that's what he does. He continues on, although he is very shaken by her passing. In the wake of all this, his regulations and regimentations were still very, very strict, and the attempts to limit free will among his followers. They all wanted to live like angels, and in order to do so, you had to strip yourself of any sexuality and sense of individualism. He even took it so far as to castrate himself. Now, he didn't require others to castrate themselves, but he did encourage them, and 6 to 7, depending on your source, more than 5 people end up joining him, and they fly to Mexico for the procedure. So as you can see, they are very dedicated and truly believe in the cause. By the early 90s, things really took off for Heaven's Gate. With the emergence of the web, Marshall took full advantage of this new technology. He even had a website before most traditional businesses did, and he used it as a new tool to spread their beliefs to a wider audience. The cult was also able to make a decent living through the internet. They created a company named Higher Source, and they would make money designing web pages. And this was very lucrative for them, let me tell ya. But despite all of this newfound success, Marshall's sense of paranoia began to ramp up. He began to view everything as a warning of doom. Around that time, California was experiencing bad fires, as it does. However, they were so bad that the sky turned red due to all the fire. And Marshall would believe that this was to be a signal of the end times. At that time, there was also a comet that was very visible from Earth. It's one of the brightest comets of that time, and it was named Hale-Bopp. This is what Marshall believed that Heaven's Gate had been waiting for. He believed that a UFO was trailing behind the comet and that it was coming to save them. At that time, the cult had already rented a mansion in San Diego with all the money that they made from their web business, so that's where they decided that they would all exit their vehicle in that mansion. In preparation to evacuate Earth, they videotaped farewells. There are clips of these on YouTube, so if you want to go check them out, definitely do. But in the videos, you can see that a lot of the followers, they were just very peaceful. They didn't seem worried at all about leaving Earth. In fact, they say that they're happy to be with Doe, aka Marshall, and that they weren't scared to die, because to them, they aren't actually dying, but they're just leaving their vehicles to escape to the next level above humans. Heaven's Gate took this evacuation plan very seriously And in the videos, you can even see them wearing little patches that say Heaven's Gate Away Team. And that phrase, the away team, seemed to be a nod to the armbands worn in Star Trek. So here's a quote from the man Marshall himself about leaving the Earth. He says, quote, "You can follow, but you can't stay on Earth to follow. You have to follow quickly by also leaving this world." They sent these exit tapes and a map to the mansion to old friends and ex-cult members in what I'm assuming was probably an attempt to have others come join them or at least inform them of what's going on, kind of being like, hey, look what you're missing out on. We're going to leave Earth and ascend to the evolutionary level above human. But that's my interpretation of that. In March of 1997, the cult goes out for their last supper together. And this took place at the Marie Callender's restaurant in Carlsbad. And as a fun side note, I actually used to work at Marie Callender's, so I found that fact to be pretty interesting. In an interview, one of the servers describes Heaven's Gate's last visit to the restaurant. They say, quote, "They all ordered the exact same thing. It was set up before they came in. They all had iced teas to drink, dinner salads beforehand with tomato vinegar dressing, turkey pot pie for the entree, and cheesecake with blueberries on top for dessert. They seemed very nice and very friendly, very polite. No one seemed depressed at all or anything like that." Now, I'm sure that they had no idea what this group of friendly people had planned next. For starting on March 22nd and 23rd, the 39 cult members ate applesauce or pudding that they had laced with heavy doses of barbiturates, and some even chased it with vodka. There was a document found labeled The Routine that outlined the process by which they would all die. They did so group by group, eating the mixture up quickly, placing bags over their heads to ensure asphyxiation, and then they would await to free themselves from their vehicles and ascend to the spaceship behind Hale-Bopp. Now, this was believed to have happened over a course of a few days. Those later in the lineup would clean up any mess made by the first group and then laid the bodies out neatly, covering them with purple shrouds. Now, the drug that they used is phenobarbital, and it's actually a depressant that shuts down breathing. It takes about 4 to 6 hours to kick in, but is much deadlier when mixed with alcohol. It's an anti-seizure medication, and it is deadly in higher quantities. I mean, obviously, it's deadly. Dr. Brian Blackburn, a San Diego medical examiner, says that the toxicology came back and confirms that they did die from the phenobarbital and alcohol. He explains that 50 to 60 pills is deadly, but that you would need even fewer with alcohol. It basically depresses your respiration to the point where you can't breathe and your heart eventually stops. Dr. Greg Thompson, a professor of clinical pharmacy and emergency medicine at USC, says that the drug is easy to get a prescription for. It costs about $3 for 100 pills and that it's easy to hoard because it won't give off any red flags like other drugs would. The pharmacist would just simply think that that person has a seizure disorder. So it made sense that they would choose this particular drug because it wouldn't set off all the alarm bells and it was decently cheap, so. Now in the end, Marshall was the 37th to die. He left behind two others who would then prepare his corpse, and then alone in a house full of bodies, they would take their own lives. An anonymous tipster, who was later revealed to be a former member, had received a disturbing package of videotaped farewells from the group as well as the map to the mansion. So he ends up calling the police to inform them that he thinks something might be going on. On March 26, the police entered the mansion to find 39 bodies lying neatly in bunk beds or other resting places. They were all dressed in identical black track suits paired with black and white Nike sneakers and covered from their head down to their torso in purple shrouds. They all had $5 of quarters in the pockets of their track suit, and they were wearing their armbands that read Heaven's Gate Away Team. As you can imagine, this was all over the news, and it shocked San Diego as well as the nation, becoming one of the most iconic mass suicides in American history. One of the images from this case that just makes it so memorable is the iconic Nike shoe. Now, Nike discontinued that shoe shortly after the story came out for obvious reasons, but now that particular style of Nike is a collector's item, and people actually auction off the shoes for a fairly decent amount of money. Now, the brand name shoes were, in a way, great publicity for the cult. However, it is said that that was definitely by accident. The real reason why they all had Nikes on is because they bought them in bulk, and they got them at a really good price because they bought them in bulk. Marshall and the other followers did like the style, but they had them mostly because of the cost, not necessarily because of the popularity of that brand. Because again, they were trying to be like angels and leave behind their human ways, so things like materialism wasn't important to them. But it is a bit iconic and I guess a bit morbid that Nike's catchphrase is just do it, because, well, they did. So yeah, that's a really bad meme that goes around, but there you go. Now, although Heaven's Gate did evacuate the Earth, that doesn't mean that their cult and the ideology behind it died with them. It is said that there are at least four surviving members who were left behind in order to run the Higher Source website, which is still operational to this day. These remaining members claim to be in contact with the other 39, and that they are still trying to fulfill the mission of saving others from the end times and elevating to the next level. Here's a quote from them. They say, "The information must be available to mankind in preparation for the return. We don't know when that will be, but those who are interested will find the information." So, there you go, guys. That's the story behind Heaven's Gate. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and remember, it is super important to keep an open mind, but in doing so, never ever lose sight of what makes you you and what makes you special, because at the end of the day, that is truly what matters, and that is truly what makes this world such a beautiful place. So with all of that said, that's all I've got for you guys today. So until next time, stay safe.